Welcome everyone to Impact Investing Musings, a podcast series where we delve into the ever-evolving world of impact investing and aim to connect, educate, and share knowledge to drive capital towards impact. I'm Vikas Arora, Chief of Impact Investing at AVPN. In this inaugural episode, we explore the nuanced journey of impact investing in Asia. And I'm delighted to introduce our guest speaker for this episode, Wai Chiu Chik, Chief Executive Officer of Heritas Capital Management, a Singapore-based multi-fund impact investing platform. And joining us to lead this conversation is our host, Taimur Nabili, a veteran journalist with over three decades of experience across the globe as an anchor.
Wai Chiu began by explaining how he defines impact investing.
Well, I would say that impact investing is really putting capital to work with an intent of creating both environmental and or social benefits to the communities that you aim to benefit.
What do you think actually fits under that definition? And what is excluded from that definition?
Well, I would say that, you know, when people talk about impact investing, I think there are potentially many other related concepts in mind. For example, there could be an idea of looking at ESG factors, right? And so there's a very popular misconception that ESG investing is impact investing. We don't really see it that way. I think that, you know, when we consider ESG, there is a part of ESG investing that is really looking at avoiding harm, which is a very worthwhile goal where you actually try to avoid environmental impact and you avoid bad social outcomes from your investment. But from my perspective, impact investing goes beyond that, where the focus would be like, how do you intentionally, through your investment, achieve something good, you know, for environmental and for social perspective. So there is a part of looking at ESG as an opportunity to explore rather than some harm that you are just trying to avoid. And that is really how I see the evolution from ESG investing to really looking at impact investing.
This evolution's been gone for a long time, hasn't it? I mean, we've had ideas of religion and morality and political and ethical criteria have been part of this conversation for millennia, haven't they?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, probably if I look back with a broader kind of historical perspective, as you alluded to, I would say that even through the Industrial Revolution, right, where, you know, the advance of the manufacturing techniques through coal production that enables the first steps of industrialization to fulfill the creation of goods that meets the needs and aspirations of the people then, there are already pushbacks where people become concerned of the living and working conditions of these workers, right? So you're right. I mean, end of the day, we are always reflecting, and I think that is a good thing, that as we achieve more material progress, we also look at how things are done and whether we are really benefiting people who matter the most. Right? So in more recent years, the 20 over years that I've been exposed to looking at how we can make investment work for the community and for environment, I would say that these kind of debates continue, right? And even now, in recent years, people talk about stakeholder capitalism, right? And that is where you have a broader view on how you could take care of stakeholders' interests instead of rather narrow shareholder interests. And all this thinking is also reflected in the way we make investments, right? The way we do business and the way we make investments.
Are there further subdivisions of this in different geographical regions? For instance, here we are in Asia, and the idea of fiduciary duty historically has already included things like extended family and community stakeholders, hasn't it? Do you think those are relevant judgmental criteria when we look at this?
Yeah, that's a very interesting perspective. Actually, I would think that in Asia, where we are based, We do see multi-generation families who are thinking very long-term. But then again, in Europe, actually, the multi-generation families has been passing down the business for even more generations in that regard. And then when I look at Japan, you know, there's also another good example of society where a lot of the crafts and the family skills are passed down. So I would think that, to your question, I would consider less of geographical classifications and differences, but maybe more from the causes, right, that impact investing may be after could be slightly different. So, for example, in Europe, the living standards are already high. You know, the societies are generally more uniformly prosperous. And so they could be concerned with, say, the environment preservation, you know, getting to net zero. Whereas in Asia, perhaps, you know, meeting the basic living standards and elevating the citizens out of poverty may be the first priorities of many countries in Asia still. And so when we look at impact investing, right, I can see that kind of a differences, like what are we really after, right? And how do we balance the various considerations? Because if we talk about profit, we know, right, that there is such a concept of IRR and multiples on invested capital. These are numerical, quantifiable measures. Whereas when we talk about trying to address some social and environment needs, actually, they are very varied causes, right? So it could be alleviating poverty, or it could be helping some children who have stunted growth, or it could be ocean plastics. You know, there are so many causes in the pathway of development that many impact investors are after, that in Asia, it could be quite a different field from how impact investors are pursuing their goals in Europe.
Yeah. So you mentioned measurement, and we will consider the broader issues of measurement and metrics of impact in a separate upcoming episode of these podcasts. But, you know, it's hard to talk and define impact without thinking about measurement and metrics, is it? Because they're kind of key to defining the sector.
You are absolutely right. And I think that when we were formulating our impact funds, we got to spend a lot of time thinking through it together with our potential investors. After speaking with a lot of experts, we came up with three principles. And just to share with you, the first one is really intentionality. I think that is very fundamental to impact investing. Then the second aspect is materiality, right? In other words, material to the success of the intent, rather than having really like a full dashboard of indicators, which may be very cumbersome to measure. And the third perspective, the third principle that we do apply is actually collinearity, right? Where we would like to see how business in achieving some of these metrics can actually scale both the impact as well as the success, right? Because ultimately, sustainable business can sustainably deliver impact only if it is sustainably profitable, right? Because it's not sustainable if a business cannot demonstrate profitability, even if it's doing the most good in the world.
Yeah, I was thinking more in terms, not so much of how do we define measurement and metrics, but how measurement and metrics define what we call impact investment. Because, you know, we talk about evolution, don't we? And the kind of things that we can measure and the techniques and the processes that we are using to measure impact or intangible assets, and how we then present those measurements. These things are all still very much in a state of flux, aren't they? And so when you say ESG investment is no longer really considered an impact investment per se, that's partly because our definitions of measurement are changing.
Yeah. Actually, you have a point there, right? When I thought about like certain ESG perspective not being impact, mainly is because I see that, you know, avoidance of harm is no longer sufficient, right? I mean, if you are doing a commercial investment, yeah, and you are mindful that your investment is not causing harm and you check that, I think that is good, right? That is better than doing a commercial investment without regard to any harm. that you might be doing, right? So being mindful about the potential ESG harm is better than not being mindful. So from that perspective, I would say that ESG investing is to be encouraged. However, I would encourage even a higher bar where we think about while making investment that can be justified from a commercial angle, we also think in that process, are there environment and social enhancements that we can make as part of the considerations of a commercial investments? Now, your question is about then, perhaps if you talk about measurements and metrics, what are those environment and social benefits that we could derive? And we could, you know, have the impact investing community debate and discuss that a lot more. And that is a worthwhile exercise. But I just want to differentiate, you know, from ESG investing that is purely trying to avoid harm to enhancing, you know, the benefits from perspective of environment and society.
So much of impact is an intangible quantity, isn't it? And so your average impact investor is going to say, okay, how can I balance my financial return and the return of those intangible assets, and how can I weigh up what they achieve for me? Tell me what your thoughts are on that balance between the financial return and the impact, and how an impact investor should look at potential investment through that lens.
Yes, actually, we see in the market impact funds that claim that their returns are not lower than commercial returns. And then there are also impact funds that actually propose returns that is more concessional than equivalent commercial returns as well. I can understand, you know, both, if I may call it the schools of thought, right? We have operated a growth fund and a venture fund where we actually emphasize on impact, right? So we may invest in healthcare or education businesses, and we actually bear in mind the kind of social outcomes in these cases, like, you know, how do we benefit some of the students from, you know, these investments, how do they benefit and so on. And we capture those metrics as well as reporting on the financial traction. So if you look at it from a commercial standpoint, that these healthcare and education investments should do as well, right? Whether it's a roll-up strategy, I can see that the kind of returns will not be worse. Right. To give you a very concrete example, and I've shared this with many of my investors, I could choose to do education investment that cater to the lower middle income groups. Perhaps I could serve 100,000 students with my investment, and the kind of profit per student is actually not that high. But because I find a business model to serve 100,000 students, cumulatively, I could still achieve a certain profit, right? Versus, right, many commercial investors looking at high-end international schools where the school fees could be like $50,000 a year, right? That could be a very viable business model. Now, for me, operating as an impact investor, I would love to achieve commercial returns while serving more students, right, who otherwise will not have access to such private education opportunities. So from that perspective, it is possible to have commercial returns if you create a business model that could serve more people who needed that kind of solutions where otherwise they would not have such access. Okay, so this would be the kind of impact funds that could create commercial returns and also impact objectives which some investors would value. Right? Now, on the other hand, there are another kind of impact investing that actually also take into account that externalities, right? Where we then realize that if you factor in all the externalities, positive and negative, of particular investments, that actually the commercial returns is actually just not taking into account some of the externalities. So some impact investors are prepared to accept lower returns because you do want to make sure that investments are made from a very responsible standpoint and taking into account unintended consequences. So I would think that given different kinds of investors have got different inclinations. That is why in the market there exists impact funds that still target commercial returns. And there are impact funds that actually proposes a more concessional returns rate, which then actually try to maximize the impact.
So for an investor, let's say a member of AVPN who has family money or philanthropic money or perhaps even an institution, a pension fund, what is your advice to people who are looking at making an impact investment? What are the first steps they should be taking and the first things they should be examining as they try to decide what is an appropriate investment that meets their own criteria?
Yeah, Temo, there's a great question that many of our family office investors actually ponder over, right? And the best practice I've seen is that the family actually gets together and ask themselves, you know, what does the family stand for? So it's not so much the doing, but the being first, right? Like who are they? What do they stand for? What do they value? And then it's a question of how to execute that and express those values through multiple channels, including philanthropy, impact investing, commercial investing, and so on and so forth. Now, once the family, it could be an individual, right, who could be the first generation founder or business, or it could be, you know, subsequent generations who get together and discuss for themselves, you know, how they would like to allocate their wealth that they have inherited, right? But to me, that is a very important first step, because the rest of it is, a lot of it is really the execution. We have seen family offices that have pockets where it is for philanthropy and then pockets for investing, so that the returns from making the investment can fund the philanthropic causes. We have also seen family office that actually look at doing impact investing, which achieve both philanthropic objectives, social objectives, at the same time as achieving some impact returns, right? So we have seen a variety of methods and allocation algorithms. But I think first and foremost, the family must be able to determine what do they stand for and how do they want to allocate their wealth.
Are there any specific legal, regulatory, financial, or fiduciary concerns that apply here that should be taken into account, whether you are the investor or you are the person managing the investment?
Yeah, actually for us, we are a fund management firm. We run 7 funds looking at ESG integration as well as impact investing. So for us, the most straightforward answer is that each of the fund has got a particular mandate. We got to, you know, deploy this capital in accordance to that mandate. Now, as for the investors, our investors, they will also have to consider their own mandate, right? Whether investing in a fund like ours or any other funds would be in accordance with those mandates. And how do these mandates come about? As I mentioned earlier, is something that the families got to get together and so understand what they stand for and where they want to allocate their wealth and capital. Now, there are other considerations, obviously. For example, if you get into philanthropic investment, there could be tax implications, there could be regulatory considerations and things like that. So usually there are wealth management, wealth advisors, family office advisors that will actually look into these aspects with the principals.
The conversation around impact investment often seems to focus almost exclusively on venture capital. But venture capital, obviously, in the world of financial investment is a very small part of that landscape. So what about listed equities? Is there a qualitative difference? Is there a different approach one should take when thinking about getting impact or exercising impact through listed equities rather than going through a VC?
Yeah. Great question, Demo. Frankly, it's really a question of additionality, right? I mean, we talked about impact investing on venture capital level. Well, to be more precise, you know, when you make an impact investment into a small company rather than big listed companies, what exactly is the difference, right? So for us, at least, when we are looking at making an investment into startups who are creating new ideas and new possibilities, there are certain pros and cons, right? Obviously, small companies are less robust. They may have a less proven business model. But at the same time, it would mean that active impact investors may have a hand and contribution to working with the founders of these early stage companies in shaping the pathway forward. So from that standpoint, the additionality, the concept of additionality can apply a lot more. That means to say, when you put your capital to work, you could potentially make a bigger difference, right? If I were to put in simple terms. Whereas if you are looking at investing in a listed company, and in the simplest sense, it's just changing hands of shares, right? So if I were to buy a share of Singtel, for example, right? Basically, I'm buying shares from someone, right? And it changed hands from you to me. And frankly, the business still continue on its trajectory. So from that standpoint, the additionality is not high. One could still say, right, that by choosing to buy shares of what you regard as a business that is conducting impact, that you have allocated capital for impactful companies, but this capital does not actually get put to work because it was just changing hands at the shares level for listed company. So I hope I sort of put it at the risk of oversimplification to illustrate the concept of what we mean by additionality.
So we talked earlier on about the evolution of the market. Let's talk about the evolution in terms of the size and awareness. The awareness of impact and the interest in impact seemed to take off a few years ago and became very high profile. But in the past year or so, it seems as if there's been a bit of a drop off in that interest and in the amount of money flowing into the impact space. Just tell me about how that market size has been taken over, what the growth has been in numbers, and whether you see that being an upward trajectory on a consistent basis.
Your description, your narrative is spot on, right? When I begin my career, right, about 15, 20 years ago, at that time, the dominant thinking of investing is make your commercial returns, maximize it, generate returns for your investors, and leave it to your investors to allocate for doing good. Okay, so it is a kind of a sequential, very separated kind of activities, right? So investment is for maximizing returns. And when these returns are given, distributed back to investors, they can do whatever good they want, right? I think in the more recent 10 years, there is a greater awareness shift where investors are realizing that, why do I need to have this two-step process? Right. Why not, while making the investments, we also care that, you know, we do no harm, plus, if possible, also do good, right? So that, you know, we don't potentially create an issue and then go and solve it. And I think in the last 10 years, the awareness is also shifted on the bigger front, right? On political front, where, you know, we look at greater social inequalities, the 99% movement, the whole emergence of a new brand of political populism in some of the biggest countries. And so those are reflected in those trends where, you know, if you think about putting America first, underlying it is really the kind of social inequalities and seen as injustice, for example. And then, of course, going forward, the whole notion of stakeholder capitalism has emerged, where, you know, I think even the most established Fortune 500 companies and boards are realizing that it is not just about shareholder returns. They got to factor in the wider community in order to build a sustainable business. So concurrently on the investment front, the whole notion of investing for example, the UN SDG goals, and also the whole idea of looking at ESG as an opportunity and not as harm avoidance. And then the whole emergence of impact investing gaining more traction, right? So that is the evolution of the last 15, 20 years. And I would think that, you know, this growth of this approach will not be a straight line. There will be excesses where people feel that you go too far in one direction, and there will be some reflections on, you know, why have you overcompensated or overly adjusted like many other things in the world? And to me, that is not a bad thing, right? But moving forward, what I do see is that there is increased consciousness that people are concerned, right, about social issues and even for climate change, right? I think if you look back 5 to 10 years ago, many people would even regard climate change as a hoax, right? But I think today, fewer and fewer people think so. And there's a lot more concrete measures by governments and by communities, by NGOs, by companies working to demonstrate their role and putting money where their mouth is in terms of improving the environment. So I think there is a convergence of multiple shifts, both global, geopolitical, political, social, environmental, technological, actually converging to move our approaches in impact investing on this front.
Who are the players leading the evolution, driving the growth of the market, not just from a financial perspective, but from a leadership role, a thought leadership role?
Yeah, I think many actors, even the largest of them, are really approaching based on the underlying structure of forces that they are seeing, right? I mean, on one hand, we have the UN laying down the SDG goals, right? Social development goals. And a lot of investors take reference from the UN and the SDG goals that are set and then moving towards that. That provide, in a way, a North Star for many impact funds to align their impact objectives towards as well. And many governments on their own have also been looking at how to create better social and environmental balances. I mean, you look at the recent Singapore budget, putting aside billions of dollars to look at a new energy fund, putting money to defend the coast, you know, from rising sea levels and making a social redistribution to make sure that, you know, nobody gets left behind and things like that. So both at the international environment as well as governments of various countries are actually putting in such effort. Nonprofits, right? I used to work at the World Economic Forum, right? And its motto was, has been, and I think today it still is, right? Improving the state of the world. Okay. And, you know, that is where they have been promoting social entrepreneurship. Corporates, right? DBS, for example, DBS has a foundation, DBS Foundation, that actually champions social enterprises. Right. So, and then of course we have the B Corp movement, and of course not to forget the likes of AVPN, you know, pulling the community and organizing and spearheading many worthwhile objectives to drive people together. So from all these standpoint, whether it's government, nonprofit, corporates, this awareness of the need to build more sustainable societies is very, very critical.
There's a massive gap between what the UN tells us is necessary in order to meet our climate goals and the amount of money that's actually being invested in those projects. So how can we bridge that gap, and how can institutions like AVPN help unlock private money, enough private money, to really make a difference?
Oh, that's a real good point. You know, based on the studies and that I've seen too, right? It seems like you need more than $1 trillion every year, right, in order to actually address some of the climate goals and to avoid 1.5% temperature rise, 1.5 degrees temperature rise. And, you know, on one hand, there are encouraging developments like more and more countries signing on to declare, you know, to meet their targets, you know, net zero by 2050, you know, like for India is 2070 and so on. On the other hand, we also see that the actual implementation on the ground is actually taking some time. And a lot of these are to do perhaps with the kind of incentives to be able to achieve those goals. I mean, private money at the end of the day may also have to take into account, you know, whether making those investments make financial sense or not. So I do understand AVPN is also exploring potential approaches like blended finance, where then you need to pull capital from public, private and philanthropic sources in order to crowd in more investments into these necessary areas. pulling all these sources of capital together is not easy, right? Because aligning everyone's kind of approaches and preferences is a difficult challenge. So that is the reason why we don't see great momentum with these approaches. But I'm still optimistic that as we move forward, more and more ground-up initiatives can still move the needle going forward. For example, just news, Changi Airport is talking about mandating the sustainable aviation fuel. It could start with a small percentage, right? And you've got to talk about how it will be paid for. So it will be reflected in passengers, airline passengers paying some of it. It could be contributed somewhat by some of these taxes and so on, right? So it has to be a combination of various approaches.
But I'm thinking specifically about that very problem of getting money, private money, to redirect itself towards real impact project. We keep hearing from the private sector that there's plenty of money to invest, and yet we don't see it going into these actual projects. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts about ways that we can really unlock that money.
Yeah, Timo, I mean, again, right, why is private capital not well mobilized, right? It's because the incentives on the ground is not there. If you put money as an investment, what would you expect? Private capital will expect a certain kind of return. So if the market itself does not provide that incentives for making an investment, that gap of investing will continue to persist. So when I give you the example of sustainable aviation fuel, right? Nobody will want to produce sustainable aviation fuel, build a plant to produce it, if there is no government policy and mandate for airlines to use those fuel. I think the government got to be very thoughtful and deliberate on the way that it design and implement its policy so as to create the viable conditions for private investment.
What particular conditions do you think need immediate attention?
So It is really a transitional thinking that the government got to undergo in order to foster a market for triggering and enabling private investment. Another example is actually carbon pricing, right? If the government does not step in and say that, okay, this is how I will tax carbon emission, and this is the price I will tax carbon, per ton and so on, then there is no price to carbon emission, and there is no incentive to invest to deal with reducing or removing carbon emissions. So these two examples help illustrate the critical government role in enabling private capital to be mobilized in the first place. If these things are not done, then we could urge private capital to move, right, and to be deployed all we want, but nothing is going to happen and the gaps will persist.
All right. Bye. We'll leave it there. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
That was Waichu Chick, the CEO of Heritas. Do join us for the second episode of this series, when we'll consider the issue of impact measurement and management. Our guest for that conversation will be Hao Liang. He's the Ho Bi Professor of Sustainability Management and Associate Professor of Finance at Singapore Management University. See you then.